fields of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This, I repeat, is the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. If the superpowers could agree on arms reductions and limitations, this government is ready to ask its people to join with all nations in devoting a substantial percentage of the savings achieved by disarmament to a fund for world aid and reconstruction. The purposes of this great work would be to help other peoples to develop the undeveloped areas of the world, to stimulate profitable and fair world trade, to assist all peoples to know the blessings of productive freedom. All that was needed, apparently, was goodwill and sincerity. We are ready, in short, to dedicate our strength to serving the needs rather than the fears of the world. Among the finest words Eisenhower would utter in his time in the White House, his speech was acclaimed as a heartfelt appeal for peace and arms reduction. The text was circulated in printed brochures around the world. The Voice of America rebroadcast it in 45 languages. The World Press commented on it. His chief of staff, Sherman Adams, called it the most effective speech of Eisenhower's public career. Yet it did not alter the course of the Cold War or even temper the arms race. It proved an empty gesture. Why so little impact? The chance for peace failed to ease the Cold War because Stalin's death did nothing to alter the fundamental ideological and geopolitical rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union. Each superpower still saw the other as a looming threat to its security, its belief system, and its vision of the future. The ideological trenches were dug too deep, and the risks of appearing weak or engaging in appeasement were too great for either side to commit to a genuine thawing of relations. The Soviet Union was now in the hands of a nervous team of men who had risen in the Soviet system by slavishly attending to Stalin's every caprice. For a brief moment, Malenkov, Nikita Khrushchev, Lavrenty Beria, and Nikolai Bulganin had hoped that a thaw with the West would buy them time to transition to a post-Stalin period of rule. But they dared not loosen the reins over the communist bloc for fear of letting it slip away. In June 1953, East German workers rose up in open defiance of the communist government in East Berlin, and the Soviets were obliged to send in tanks and soldiers to restore control. The post-Stalin thaw evaporated after just 3 months. Meanwhile, Eisenhower, despite his inspiring rhetoric about the terrible waste of the global arms race, seemed unwilling to move from words to deeds. He approved a surprisingly belligerent speech that his Secretary of State delivered a mere 48 hours after the chance for peace hit the airwaves. Aiming to reassure both the right wing of the GOP and allies abroad that the United States was not seeking peace from a position of weakness, Dulles publicly itemized the many ways in which the new administration had aggressively beefed up the U.S. military presence around the world. Dulles boasted that the United States was arming Western Europe, intensifying its operations in Korea, speeding delivery of military assistance to the nationalist Chinese, pouring arms into French Indochina, and strengthening ties to governments in the Middle East and Latin America. The United States would not accept any settlement of the Cold War that perpetuates the captivity of hundreds of millions of persons behind the Iron Curtain. If the Soviets wanted to ask for peace, the administration would listen to their proposals, but we do not play the role of suppliants. 2 days after the Chance for Peace speech, Dulles put the world on notice. America was still waging the Cold War and would seek nothing less than victory. Eisenhower's actions following Stalin's death set something of a pattern for his presidency. He was emotionally and personally attached to the idea of peace. He spoke eloquently about the horrors of war and his desire to turn the productive capacities of humanity away from swords and toward plowshares. But Eisenhower was not an impulsive man. As a general, he had developed a reputation as a master planner, a man who husbanded power, amassed resources, and always fought from a position of overwhelming strength. As president, he followed the same strategic principles, choosing to wage a long, patient struggle with the USSR, in which American power would eventually win out, rather than make any sudden or risky move that could leave the nation vulnerable. There would be many sincere words of peace during his presidency, but Ike was always preparing for war. 4. To win the Cold War, Eisenhower believed, the United States must remain economically dynamic, robust, and expansive. Spending huge sums on armaments and national defense might be unavoidable, but it had to be done carefully. Since 1940, the United States had swung between extremes, from total lack of preparedness to breakneck and improvised rearmament programs. In a long confrontation with the Soviets, the watchword must be balance. The nation must build a permanent strategic defense capability while also avoiding inflation, spending prudently, and encouraging private innovation and economic growth. Rather than turn the country into a garrison state built upon a command economy, Eisenhower proposed to wage the Cold War along free market principles moderated by wise fiscal management. His first budget reflected these convictions. Truman's last budget had proposed total spending of $78.6 billion against revenue of $68.7 billion, thus leaving a deficit of $9.9 billion. A shocking gap as far as Eisenhower was concerned. Ike called for belt tightening. Though since 70% of Truman's 1953 budget went toward defense spending and the costs of the Korean War, the cuts would have to come from the military. Treasury Secretary Humphrey strongly supported this approach. He told the National Security Council, "The money and resources required by the great security programs which had been developed since Korea to the present time simply could not be borne by the United States unless we adopted essentially totalitarian methods." By that he meant that continued massive overspending on behalf of the military would make the United States no different from its nemesis, the Soviet Union. Humphrey told the president that we were at a fork in the road and a decision would have to be made. The country needed to make basic changes in national security policies and programs. Designed by Joseph Dodge, a Detroit banker of vast international experience, Eisenhower's 1954 budget made real cuts to Truman's spending plans. Truman had wanted to spend $78.6 billion. Ike trimmed that figure to $72.1 billion, a reduction of 8%. Instead of a budget deficit of $9.9 billion, Eisenhower expected a budget deficit for 1954 of $3.8 billion, still large, but far less than Truman had proposed. For Truman's defense budget for 1954 was $45.4 billion, Eisenhower's was $41.6 billion. An additional $1.4 billion was cut out of the Mutual Security Program, that is, military and economic aid to nations in Western Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America. These cuts had been hard to achieve. Secretary of Defense Wilson had to wage a long battle with the service chiefs, as the budget savings were attained mainly by cutting non-combat personnel by 250,000. This decision had a knock-on effect because a smaller military workforce meant slower training, production, and procurement of weapons systems, especially aircraft. Advocates of air power in Congress, including prominent Democrats like Representative George H. Mahon of Texas and Senator Stuart Symington of Missouri, Truman's former Secretary of the Air Force, laid into the administration for slowing the expansion of air power, leaving America, they said, with merely the world's second-best air force. This would be a constant refrain from hawkish Democrats right up to the 1960 presidential election, when John F. Kennedy criticized the Eisenhower administration for its weakness on national security. But Eisenhower persevered. Not only did Democrats and the armed services object to the new budget, so too did the right wing of the GOP. To balance the budget, Eisenhower appealed to Congress to extend Truman's Korean War taxation measures, chiefly the excess profits tax on big business, and he asked for a delay in the reduction of personal income taxes that Congress had approved. This left conservative Republicans deeply distressed. On April 30th, Senator Taft, now majority leader of the newly Republican Senate, went to the White House to complain. After looking over the numbers, he exploded. Eisenhower wrote in his diary that Taft broke out in violent objection to the modest cuts to Truman's budget and derided the reductions as puny. Having failed to deliver tax cuts, the GOP would take a beating at the polls in 1954, Taft predicted, and he announced that he would fight against the proposed budget. Eisenhower was stunned, then deeply offended and angered at what he considered a demagogic tirade. But Taft's outburst was a harbinger. Despite months of work to trim the budget, Eisenhower would get no easy pass from the GOP old guard. The arch-conservative Republicans mistrusted Eisenhower and were ready to pounce on any sign that he would simply carry on Truman's policies. Taft was right about one thing. Eisenhower had no intention of drastically reducing defense spending. The numbers show that Eisenhower instituted a new era of steady, generous defense appropriations. In 1940, the United States had spent a mere $1.6 billion on national defense. In 1945, after 4 years of global war, the figure had soared to a staggering $83 billion. These huge expenditures were drastically cut back after the war. By 1950, defense spending had shrunk to a mere $13.7 billion, leaving the military hollowed out. Ike, as Army Chief of Staff, had tried to sound the alarm, to no avail. With the outbreak of war in Korea in 1950, Truman turned on the spigots once again, and defense spending shot up to $53 billion by 1953. Eisenhower abjured these drastic swings in spending. They suggested an unwillingness to think ahead and stay prepared for future conflict. In his time in office, defense outlays remained remarkably steady and substantial, averaging $46.5 billion a year. This was a huge sum, representing roughly 50% of annual federal budget outlays during his administration. Put another way, the United States consistently spent 10% or more of its GDP each year on defense during the Eisenhower years, a higher percentage than any peacetime administration in U.S. history, before or since. Eisenhower allocated fewer dollars to defense than Truman did at the height of the Korean War, but Ike presided over nearly 8 years of peace, and his annual defense budgets were still more than three times what Truman's administration had spent in 1950, before Korea. "They were living in an age of peril," the president had said. "Security based on heavy armaments is a way of life that has been forced upon us and on our allies," he explained to the American public on April 30th. "We don't like it. In fact, we hate it. But so long as such an unmistakable, self-confirmed threat to our freedom exists, we will carry these burdens with dedication and determination." There was a Spartan tone to Ike's approach to national defense, fitting for a lifelong soldier. He viewed democratic government as a collective enterprise in which great benefits came to a free people only through common effort and shared sacrifice. As long as the nation faced grave threats, taxes would stay high and citizens must remain on alert. "We expect to live as a free state," he told the country in a public radio address, "which means we must develop a defense program that can carry the security burden for a long, long time, if that is necessary. And we will do it without complaining, because we've prized our freedoms that highly." This was a maxim to live by in an age of peril. 5. Having imposed a degree of restraint and order on the federal budget, Eisenhower now turned to the bleeding wound of the Korean War. To Eisenhower, as well as many Americans, the war seemed a tragic waste. It was costly. It placed a terrible drag on the domestic economy. It sapped public morale, and it did not enhance America's global position. Eisenhower had no specific plan to end the war, but he knew it must end somehow. He had inherited a difficult tangle in Korea. By the start of 1953, the battle lines had stabilized along a front that was fairly close to the 38th parallel, the pre-war border between North and South Korea. Since June 1951, the combatants had been in fitful discussions about signing an armistice, though these talks had been interrupted regularly by fierce outbursts of fighting, with the result that the war was an open sore, hurting both sides but achieving little strategic purpose. After painstaking negotiations over many months, the Truman administration had managed to settle with the Chinese and North Koreans almost all the outstanding issues, except for the question of repatriating thousands of Chinese and North Korean prisoners of war in American hands, who expressed an earnest desire not to be sent home. The communist nations consistently refused to accept the American position that captured soldiers should be allowed to choose their subsequent fate, and demanded that they all be returned. The United States, by contrast, viewed forcible prisoner repatriation as morally wrong. It would not agree to surrender, against their will, North Korean and Chinese prisoners who were begging to be spared the return trip. A top-secret staff study declared that a forcible return of prisoners would constitute appeasement of the most serious sort and the grossest betrayal of trust. The domestic politics of any such deal were also toxic. President Roosevelt, at the close of the Second World War, had in fact agreed to the forcible repatriation of Soviet POWs, whose destiny thereafter was to languish in the Gulag. This was part of the hated legacy of the Yalta agreements. A Republican administration could never agree to follow such a precedent. Thus, the negotiations stalled while both sides lashed out at one another on the battlefield with periodic attacks designed chiefly to enhance their bargaining position at the peace table. It was grotesque. American soldiers were dying on behalf of a war that no one was trying to win. Eisenhower considered this situation intolerable, and he wanted to bring the whole unfortunate mess to an honorable end. But how? For many years, biographers have asserted that Eisenhower's plan for achieving an armistice in Korea was breathtakingly simple. He threatened to expand the war into China and to use nuclear weapons in the process. Ike's so-called bluff scared the Chinese and brought them to accept a reasonable deal at the peace table. This example of Eisenhower's bold leadership was promoted initially by none other than John Foster Dulles when, in 1956, he told a Life magazine reporter, James Shepley, that Eisenhower had settled on his plan to use the nuclear threat to achieve a peace deal as early as the conversations aboard the Helena in December 1952. When the Chinese and North Koreans refused to accept reasonable terms for an armistice, Shepley reported, Dulles passed along Eisenhower's ultimatum to the Chinese through the intermediary of India's leader, Jawaharlal Nehru, whose country was acting as a go-between. The results were immediate. Within 2 weeks of his trip to New Delhi, Dulles received word from Korea that the Reds appeared to have begun to negotiate seriously. The communists accepted what was a propaganda defeat for a simple reason, because they had had an unmistakable warning that further delays would no longer be met with U.S. indecisiveness. Many admiring historians and biographers, eager to highlight Eisenhower's decisive leadership style, have adhered to this explanation. However, the facts do not bear out the atomic bluff theory. When Eisenhower came into office, he, like Truman, had no secret plan or magic bullet with which to end the war. Threats of nuclear attack offered no quick fix. Truman had already tried that to no avail. Eisenhower, assessing the long-running efforts of the Truman team to arrange an armistice, had come to the conclusion that negotiations would not work either. The communists could not be trusted to keep a deal. Therefore, Eisenhower's first inclination was not to seek a negotiated end to the war, but to widen the war in search of a major victory on the battlefield. There was no bluff about his seriousness on that score. To that end, in early February, he broached the idea with his advisors of using tactical atomic weapons on the Chinese in North Korea. Although the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, his former classmate Omar Bradley, discouraged this, Eisenhower laid down a marker. We could not go on the way we were indefinitely. On March 21st, he reiterated the possibility of building up United Nations conventional forces in order to deliver a massive blow and reach the waist of Korea, that is, push even farther north, to about the 39th parallel, and then impose a settlement upon a defeated enemy. He knew such a military objective would likely require an attack directly on the territory of China. 10 days later, Eisenhower seemed to be settling on a plan that would significantly expand the war in Korea. The minutes of his statement at the NSC meeting record his chilling reasoning. If, he said, we decide to go up to the strength which will be necessary to achieve a sound tactical victory in Korea, for example, to get to the waist, the Russians will very quickly realize what we are doing. They would respond by increasing the communist strength in Korea, and as a result we would be forced into a situation very close to general mobilization in order to get such a victory in Korea. The president then raised the question of the use of atomic weapons in the Korean War. Admittedly, he said, there were not many good tactical targets, but he felt it would be worth the cost if, through use of atomic weapons, we could, one, achieve a substantial victory over communist forces, and two, get to a line at the waist of Korea. Eisenhower knew that America's allies would be very reluctant to follow such a course, but somehow or other the taboo which surrounds the use of atomic weapons would have to be destroyed. There was no bluff in these words. Eisenhower was deadly serious. If compelled to wage a prolonged war in Korea, he would do so with one end in sight. Victory. But I got lucky. He never had to make the terrible decision to launch nuclear weapons in Korea. It is a paradox that while American officials were contemplating a significant increase in the intensity of the war, the Chinese and Soviets were moving in the opposite direction. The Chinese Foreign Minister Zhou Enlai in Moscow for Stalin's funeral in mid-March held discussions with the new Soviet leaders about the Korean War. The Soviets, still seeking to ease global tensions, decided that it was urgently necessary to end the war and instructed the Chinese to give in on the POW issue. As it happens, the North Koreans too were ready to end the war. The intensive American bombing had devastated virtually the whole of the North, so much so that Pyongyang had been obliterated. Kim Il-sung, the North Korean dictator, seemed positively relieved at the Soviet decision. On March 31st, the Soviet Council of Ministers made it official, stating that China, North Korea, and the USSR were all agreed on seeking an end to the war. Yet these hopeful signs were as yet unseen in Washington and so did not immediately influence American planning. On April 2nd, the NSC Planning Board submitted to the President its staff report titled Possible Courses of Action in Korea. The document's authors assumed that the stalemate at the negotiating table would not be broken and that the war would continue. In such a case, there seemed two broad policy choices: to continue the war while avoiding any attacks directly on China, and thus ensuring the war did not widen or drag in the USSR, or to intensify the war by combining a large-scale offensive in Korea with air and naval attacks against targets in China, including the use of atomic weapons. Instead of offering a path to peace, the NSC envisioned more war on the horizon. Fortunately, Eisenhower did not have to choose between these two poisoned cups. Following their discussions with the Soviets, the Chinese began to make surprising new concessions at the armistice talks in Panmunjom. On April 11th, General Mark Clark, the commander of UN forces in Korea, informed Washington, "The sense here is that the communists probably want an armistice," which they demonstrated by agreeing to an exchange of sick and wounded prisoners in mid-April. Between April 9th and May 3rd, 700 United Nations POWs came back across the battle lines in exchange for 7,000 communist POWs. The communists seemed ready to compromise, a fact not lost on South Korean President Syngman Rhee. He was staunchly opposed to the division of Korea and alarmed at this sudden change of heart by the Chinese. He wrote an anguished letter to Eisenhower denouncing any kind of armistice that would leave Korea divided. Eisenhower coolly replied that it would not be defensible to refuse to stop the fighting on an honorable basis. And in early May, hopes were raised again by a major communist concession at the negotiating table. They agreed to the creation of a commission of neutral nations to take custody of the soldiers who refused repatriation and to screen them independently. A long debate ensued about which countries would provide this service. Poland, Czechoslovakia, Switzerland, Sweden, and India were eventually enlisted. But by the beginning of May 1953, an armistice was in reach, and no nuclear threats had been made to the Chinese or Soviets. Even as these encouraging steps were being made, American military planners and the president himself were preparing for the possibility that a peace deal might fall through. Over the previous 3 years, the communist side had often used prolonged armistice negotiations as a screen for reinforcing their military positions. Eisenhower was determined not to be caught unprepared. During May and June, as peace talks were inching their way to a conclusion, he held numerous discussions with the Joint Chiefs of Staff about developing a contingency plan for widening the war and hitting the enemy savagely if the talks failed. In these conversations, Eisenhower rather breezily discussed the use of atomic weapons against the enemy in the event that the war should continue. He had reached the point, he told General Bradley, of being convinced that we have got to consider the atomic bomb as simply another weapon in our arsenal. The Joint Chiefs, aware of the president's predilections, incorporated the use of atomic weapons into their contingency planning. They concluded that the only way to impose a solution on the battlefield was to increase bombing of North Korea so as to destroy effective communist military power in Korea. This would also require extensive bombing of targets in China. Yet it is important to note that these plans were to be used only in case the armistice talks collapsed and the war continued to 1954. To make America's position clear, Secretary Dulles in India in late May dropped hints to Nehru, hints he hoped would be passed along to the Chinese, that the Americans were quite prepared to continue the war and to significantly widen it if the talks failed. However, Dulles said nothing to Nehru about using nuclear weapons, only that if the armistice negotiations collapsed, the United States would probably make a stronger rather than a lesser military exertion, and that this might well extend the area of conflict. But the United States had been saying much the same thing publicly for many months, and this vague comment can hardly be considered a nuclear ultimatum. In any case, Nehru never reported this conversation to the Chinese, and by now threats were unnecessary. The communists had decided 2 months earlier to seek a deal to end the fighting and had already made substantial concessions to secure an armistice. Nuclear saber-rattling had been irrelevant to the whole affair. If there were any American ultimatums delivered in this delicate stage of the armistice talks, they were directed not at the communist enemy, but at America's purported ally, Syngman Rhee. The South Korean leader did not want the war to end and the Americans to leave without having won a decisive victory and the unification, under his rule, of the Korean Peninsula. He opposed the armistice tooth and nail. In an attempt to sabotage the carefully structured agreements on prisoner of war exchanges that the combatant states had worked out over many months, Rhee ordered his military to release 25,000 North Korean prisoners, all of whom had declared their opposition to being repatriated. Eisenhower was stunned by this deceitful act. In the privacy of a National Security Council meeting, he fumed that if Rhee continued in this way, it was goodbye to Korea. American forces would simply withdraw, leaving South Korea to its fate. Eisenhower sent Rhee a scorching letter to this effect, but Secretary Dulles had a hunch, a correct one, as it turned out, that the communists really want an armistice so badly that they will be willing to overlook the release of the prisoners. The real problem was Rhee, Would he accept an armistice and not start the war again on his own authority? On July 2nd, Eisenhower directed his military staff to make a show of planning for the exit of U.S. forces from Korea. Just days later, Rhee agreed to accept the armistice in exchange for a mutual security pact with the United States and substantial financial aid to assist in reconstruction. Having reeled in his reluctant and high-strung ally with a combination of threats and incentives, Eisenhower now had a settlement in reach. On July 27, 1953, the armistice was signed, and a much-hated war came to an end. 3 years of heroism, frustration, and bloodshed were over, he reflected. 45,000 Americans had been killed or went missing in Korea. Over 200,000 North Koreans and as many as 400,000 Chinese died in the war. And yet Korea remained divided, its new frontier scarcely different from where it had been 3 years earlier. What did Eisenhower learn from the Korean experience? Above all, he concluded, no more Koreas. And he also came to believe, erroneously, that America's warlike disposition and atomic threats had been essential in bringing the Chinese to the armistice table. These twin conclusions, avoid quagmires and carry a big nuclear stick, would shape Eisenhower's strategic thinking for the duration of his administration. 6. These strategic principles now found their way into official policy. During the summer and early fall of 1953, Eisenhower directed his national security team to prepare a top-secret document that articulated America's grand strategy for the global Cold War. Before drafting this new statement of policy, Robert Cutler put together an elaborate staff study exercise called Operation Solarium, named after the White House parlor in which Ike and Dulles had first hatched the project. Cutler assembled three teams of leading policy and military officials under elaborate security precautions at the National War College on the grounds of Fort McNair in southwest Washington, D.C. For 6 grueling weeks, each team evaluated one of 3 policy hypotheses: that America should continue with a more robust version of Truman's policy of containment, that America should draw a line on the world map to demarcate its sphere of influence and go to all-out general war if the Soviets crossed that line, or that America should not wait any longer but go on the offensive now and attempt to roll back the Soviet bloc. The voluminous planning documents reveal how seriously each team took its mission. But the exercise remained at best an intellectual one, for the president had already settled in his mind the broad contours of America's Cold War strategy. This was made perfectly clear on July 16th when the three teams presented their conclusions to Eisenhower in an all-day meeting in the White House conference room. After listening to the reports, Eisenhower thanked the teams for their hard work but reflected that the only thing worse than losing a global war was winning one. The American people had no desire to wage a war of annihilation against the USSR and then find itself responsible for yet another long-term project of rehabilitation of a defeated enemy. The best policy for the nation must be one of strategic patience, resilience, and vigilance. Great power war in the nuclear age was simply unthinkable. As one shrewd participant noted, Ike flatly contradicted the rhetorical fulminations of Dulles. Rollback sank. It was finished off as of that day. Eisenhower now directed his national security team to draft the strategic concept paper that would define the basic principles of American policy for a long Cold War with the Soviet Union. What emerged in October 1953 was the document Basic National Security Policy, referred to by its numerical designation NSC 162-2. In a briskly written 27 pages, the NSC staff described a strategy for meeting the Soviet threat while avoiding any serious weakening of the U.S. economy or undermining our fundamental values and institutions. It was one of the most important statements of American security policy ever written, for within it lay the plans for the creation of the military-industrial complex. NSC-162-2 lucidly defined the main global threat faced by the country. Soviet hostility toward the United States, combined with a rapidly growing Soviet military and a communist Chinese regime that had established itself in Asia. The communist bloc was large, populous, and ideologically menacing. Even if the likelihood of a Soviet attack on the United States remained small, NSC-162-2 asserted that the Soviets could sustain a long ideological struggle, hoping to spread their doctrine in the Third World among newly independent nations and stirring up instability and revolution around the world. To defend against such a devious global enemy, the United States would above all have to develop and expand its arsenal of nuclear weapons, for here was the key deterrent to keep the Soviets in check. As long as the United States maintained a strong military posture, with emphasis on the capability of inflicting massive retaliatory damage by offensive striking power, the Soviets would not risk general war. Eisenhower accepted that nuclear weapons were now a part of the landscape of world affairs, and he would use them if necessary. In the event of hostilities, NSC-162-2 stated, "The United States will consider nuclear weapons to be as available for use as other munitions." But nuclear weapons were only one part of the grand strategy. Eisenhower's planners called for full mobilization of American society to ward off the communist threat. NSC-162-2 demanded not merely more and bigger nuclear weapons, along with the aircraft to deliver those bombs. It also called for a robust intelligence network to analyze Soviet behavior, coupled with elaborate security measures to combat domestic spying. It outlined a nationwide manpower program, emphasizing scientific and technical training to serve military needs. It insisted upon military readiness through stockpiling and securing of vital raw materials and key industrial plants. The concept paper envisioned huge continental defense systems with early warning radar and a large air force that could meet Soviet intruders. It called for the overhaul of military service requirements for American citizens, with longer tours of duty for draftees, inclusion of women into the armed services, and the enlistment of civilians for maintenance work. And the strategy insisted on a better public effort to explain to the American people why such a militaristic mobilization of their society was needed. Eisenhower's policy, then, cannot be called restrained or passive. To be sure, it envisioned patience rather than provocation and war. But to wage a prolonged geopolitical and ideological struggle with the communist bloc required a transformation in American capabilities and mentalities. In these first months of his presidency, Eisenhower laid down a blueprint for the warfare state, an official plan to mobilize the nation and put it on a permanent war footing. The military-industrial complex had begun to take shape. 7. As Commander-in-Chief, Eisenhower could impose his new strategy on his subordinates, but selling it to America's allies proved more difficult. In early December 1953, he traveled to Bermuda for a conference with his wartime comrade Winston Churchill, once again serving as the British Prime Minister. The two men were joined by their French counterpart, Prime Minister Joseph Laniel, who developed a high fever as soon as he arrived and was thus sidelined for the duration of the conference. Churchill had just turned 79. The previous June he had suffered a stroke that left him weakened and diminished. His hearing, too, was failing, and his family and inner circle of advisors thought it was time for him to cede power to his longtime protege and foreign minister, Anthony Eden. Churchill refused. With a supreme effort, he worked to recover his mobility after the stroke, and by December, he had gained enough strength to travel to Bermuda for a week of discussions with the American president. The leaders used the Mid-Ocean Club as their gathering place, a large white stucco colonial-style hotel that looked out across gently rolling golf links to pink beaches and a shimmering blue sea. Churchill had gone to Bermuda with one goal in mind, to arrange a four-power summit of America, Britain, France, and the USSR to discuss all the major issues in the Cold War, especially the possible unification of Germany. The death of Stalin seemed to him to open the prospect of ending the Cold War if only the world leaders could grasp the moment. Churchill yearned to play the role of honest broker, bringing together the hawkish Americans and the suspicious Soviets and sealing a grand bargain that might significantly improve world relations. Such a deal might place the capstone on his storied career, whose days were clearly numbered. Yet in Bermuda, Churchill found an Eisenhower who was in no mood for compromise. The smiling Ike of the war years, the genial consensus builder, was gone. In his place was a man of firm opinions and deep anti-Soviet sentiment. In reply to Churchill's appeal at the conference's opening session for a real effort to strike a deal with the new leaders of the Soviet Union, Eisenhower delivered a vulgar tirade in front of all the diplomats and officials of the three national delegations. Churchill's private secretary, John Colville, recorded the scene. Eisenhower said that as regards the prime minister's belief that there was a new look in Soviet policy, Russia was a woman of the streets, and whether her dress was new or just the old one patched, it was certainly the same whore underneath. America intended to drive her off her present beat into the back streets. Colville noted pained looks all around. In a gesture of conciliation designed to accommodate European anxieties, Eisenhower said he would offer a constructive proposal to the Soviets. For some months he had been mulling over the idea of asking the UN to create an international agency to share research on the peaceful uses of atomic energy. If the Soviet Union and the United States created a pool of atomic material dedicated to civilian energy use, the two nations could find common ground in deploying their nuclear knowledge for the betterment of the world. Eisenhower's own advisers were cool on the idea, but they understood its propaganda value. If the Soviets rejected the overture, they would bear the responsibility for turning away a constructive proposal. At Bermuda, Eisenhower discussed this scheme with the British. "The world was in a rather hysterical condition about the atomic bomb," he said, and he wanted to use an invitation he had received to speak at the UN General Assembly to point to the constructive capabilities of atomic energy. America wished to appear before the world as we really were, struggling for peace, not showing belligerence or truculence. Surely, he mused, a proposal to gather the world's scientists into a great collaborative effort to use atomic energy for peaceful purposes would bring a large number of people to our side. However, Eisenhower was quick to point out to his British allies this scheme for sharing atomic energy was not to be confused with a disarmament proposal. No, indeed. The United States planned to rely heavily on nuclear weapons to deter communist misbehavior. In an exchange that left his British partners deeply glum, the president declared that atomic weapons were now coming to be regarded as a proper part of conventional armament. If, for example, the North Koreans and Chinese broke the armistice so recently achieved in Korea, they would be struck with atomic weapons. This had been expounded in NSC 162-2 and was now American policy. Eisenhower's cool assertion triggered a mournful outpouring from Churchill. Any use of atomic weapons by America would lead to Soviet retaliation in Europe and to the destruction of all we hold dear. Ourselves, our families, and our treasures. And even if some of us temporarily survive in some deep cellar under mounds of flaming and contaminated rubble, there will be nothing to do but take a pill to end it all. Colville noted in his diary that Eisenhower's announcement of his intention to use nuclear weapons in the case of war, even a peripheral war like Korea, was news, which far outstrips in importance anything else at the conference. Eisenhower expressed some annoyance at the British in his diary that night. "We have come to the conclusion that the atom bomb has to be treated just as another weapon in the arsenal. The British, by contrast, still see atomic weapons as marking a completely new era in war, and cling to the hope, to us fatuous, that if we avoid the first use of the atom bomb, in any war, that the Soviets might likewise abstain. Secretary Dulles, in his own account of these exchanges, noted that American thinking on the subject was several years ahead of Britain's, and that the British leaders worried that there was a danger of our taking action which would be morally repellent to the rest of the world. It was a striking moment. America's closest ally viewed the evolution of America's nuclear strategy with growing alarm. With the anxieties of the British fresh in his mind, Eisenhower went forward with his proposal for U.S.-Soviet collaboration in the field of nuclear energy research. He and his White House staff flew from Bermuda directly to New York, where, at the United Nations, on December 8th, Eisenhower delivered his surprising offer. The speech carried both a warning and a promise. In the first passages of his address, Eisenhower walked through a catalog of horrifying statistics about the consequences of nuclear war. But he soon pivoted toward hope instead of fear. In a stirring passage, he said that the atom bomb should be taken out of the hands of soldiers and given to those who will know how to strip its military casing and adapt it to the arts of peace. He wanted to hasten the day when fear of the atom will begin to disappear from the minds of people. It was time to declare that the great powers were interested in human aspirations first, rather than in building up the armaments of war. In creating the International Atomic Energy Agency and turning over to it some quantity of uranium and fissionable material to be used to supply electricity to the developing world, the great powers would show their desire to use science to improve the world rather than to destroy it. While the press responded with hearty praise for Eisenhower's dramatic, eloquent, and moving address, the Soviets quite predictably called this bluff, responding that instead of discussing nuclear sharing, the great powers should agree to ban all atomic weapons. Since the United States had no interest in halting atomic weapons production, the Soviet counteroffer was swatted away, and the arms race continued unabated. Indeed, it might be asked, was Eisenhower really committed to moderating the Cold War or to altering his recently designed Cold War strategy? The evidence suggests he was not. Atoms for Peace was sold to the public as an earnest declaration of Eisenhower's desire to turn atomic weapons into plowshares, a desire to end the arms race and instead invest in science and technology for the betterment of mankind. But it was not a disarmament proposal at all. Eisenhower had decided that the United States would commit itself to a major expansion of its nuclear weapons. The Soviet Union, he believed, remained bent on world domination. Only deterrence and a credible threat to use nuclear weapons would halt Soviet expansionism. Eisenhower's UN speech certainly held out the hope that atomic energy might aid the developing world in the long run, but he nowhere suggested that he was ready to stop the rapid expansion of America's nuclear arsenal. Nothing could make this clearer than the delivery, shortly after the UN speech, of a strikingly bellicose declaration by Dulles to an audience gathered at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York in January 1954. Speaking from a text edited by the president himself, Dulles looked back over the first year of the Eisenhower administration. He spoke of how Truman's national security policies had been improvisational, expensive, reactive to Soviet threats, and unsystematic. The United States, Dulles announced, had inaugurated a new strategy to deter the USSR from any aggressive action. From now on, America would depend primarily upon a great capacity to retaliate instantly by means and at places of our choosing. Eisenhower and Dulles, just 1 month after the Atoms for Peace speech, declared that America was ready and willing to use nuclear weapons to protect its interests anywhere in the world against Soviet provocation. Eisenhower's Cold War strategy soon earned the nickname the New Look, a riff on the term used to describe the newest women's fashions then being featured in society magazines. Driven by a desire to cut the costs of defense, the New Look relied heavily upon a powerful nuclear deterrent instead of a large ground army. To be successful, the New Look had to create the impression that America was willing to unleash nuclear war to protect itself and its allies. And Dulles seemed to relish the opportunity to declare this willingness. "The free world," he wrote in Foreign Affairs in April 1954, "must make imaginative use of its powerful weapons, whether air power, naval power, or atomic weapons. A potential aggressor should know in advance that he can and will be made to suffer for his aggression more than he can possibly gain by it. Whether on a wintry Korean hillside, in a tropical Vietnamese jungle, on an arid Middle Eastern desert, or even in a charming German village, American interests all around the world would be backed by nuclear weapons." The goodwill generated by the Atoms for Peace speech evaporated like a warm breath on a cold evening. As if timed to reinforce this message, on March 1, 1954, less than a year after Eisenhower's soaring Chance for Peace message, and 3 months after the Atoms for Peace proposal at the UN, the United States set off the largest nuclear explosion in history up to that time, codenamed Castle Bravo, and detonated on the Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. The H-bomb test was measured at 15 megatons, 1,000 times the power of the Hiroshima bomb. The first year of Eisenhower's presidency had ended just the way it began, under the shadow of an ever-widening mushroom cloud. Chapter 6. Confronting McCarthy. "I don't believe we can live in fear of each other forever." 1. "I'd like to make some changes right away," said Mamie Eisenhower, blowing smoke from a freshly lit cigarette as she sat upright in bed. She had just passed her first night in the White House, and she didn't like it. She had been quartered alone in a small dressing room used by Bess Truman and given a narrow single bed. The room had one small dark closet. It would not do. She summoned the White House domestic staff and announced that the Eisenhowers would move into the large sitting room next door and use it as a bedroom. She ordered a king-size bed with a headboard upholstered in pink. Unlike the Trumans and Roosevelts, the Eisenhowers would share a bed. "That way, I can reach over and pat Ike on his old bald head anytime I want to." After 7 years of the unvarnished, unpretentious Bess Truman, the White House now had an imperious, demanding, outgoing, dynamic, and crackling First Lady. Mamie Eisenhower, with her curly bangs, her pink ribbons and ruffles, her devotion to high fashion, and her lively personality, became central to the Eisenhower style that defined Washington in the 1950s. Ever since John F. Kennedy took office in 1961, all first ladies have been measured against the incomparably glamorous and graceful Jacqueline Kennedy. Yet it was Mamie Eisenhower who inaugurated a new image for the presidential spouse. She was highly visible, trend-setting, and fashion-conscious. Her personality was lively, witty, genial, brisk, at times common and jokey, with a certain folksy affectation. According to the long-serving chief usher of the White House who worked with her every day, she was feminine to the point of frivolity, an affectionate and sentimental person who adored the pomp and circumstance and grandeur that went along with a nation's top job. Yet she ran the house with intense devotion to detail and a hawk-like watchfulness for overspending, waste, or inefficiency. Every morning she combed the newspapers looking for bargains. She approved every menu served at the White House, met daily with the White House chef, and insisted that food never be wasted. She had grown up in a well-off Denver family, but her life had been shaped by the same scrimping and saving that every officer's wife endured in the interwar army. For all her love of luxury, she took pride in sticking to a tight budget. Mamie's style matched Ike's. Together they were exemplars of a new American sense of self that marked the decades of the 1950s. Outgoing and convivial, they combined an air of success and achievement with a good degree of contented ordinariness. In later years, especially during the Kennedy era, the Eisenhower style would come to be seen as middle brow, plain, even vulgar and undignified for the White House. Yet America in the 1950s compared Mamie with the homespun, self-effacing Bess Truman and the earnest, admirable, and slightly tragic Eleanor Roosevelt. In truth, there had been no genuine glamour in the White House since Woodrow Wilson had married the lovely and aristocratic Edith Galt in 1915. Ike and Mamie brought an altogether new and refreshing change. The American public seems to relate to the confident, pragmatic, and accessible Eisenhower style. An admiring account in U.S. News and World Report welcomed the new attitude. Harry Truman surrounded himself with cronies, the magazine lamented. Eisenhower picks men for what they can do. Franklin D. Roosevelt dealt in political theories. Eisenhower distrusts theories. Herbert Hoover held himself aloof from people. Eisenhower is warmly human. Calvin Coolidge was a silent New Englander. Eisenhower talks easily and frankly. Eisenhower's traits seemed to align with a new ideal of American masculinity that was visible across the decade of the 1950s. The practical, extroverted, can-do man of business was in. The reflective intellectual, the man of irony, the calculating politician were out. Richard Nixon had called Adlai Stevenson an egghead on the campaign trail, and the epithet stuck. In the Eisenhower White House, businessmen were preferred over professors. As for Mamie, U.S. News declared her to be an adaptable, easy hostess, used to moving about and meeting people. She makes a home for her husband, handles social affairs with aplomb, likes people and gets along with them. No greater compliment could be paid, apparently, than acknowledgement of these domestic virtues. President Eisenhower was a hard-working man who regularly put in 9 and 10-hour days in the Oval Office. Yet politics was his job, not his life, and he insisted on frequent informal gatherings of friends and family. He kept up his card playing, his regular rounds of golf at Burning Tree Country Club, his dabbling in paints. He even worked on his putting and chip shots on the White House lawn. When his son, John, returned from Korea, he brought his family to visit often. The footfall of the Eisenhower grandchildren, David, Anne, Susan, and Mary Jean, could often be heard clattering through the family quarters of the presidential mansion. Eisenhower was always happy to get out of Washington. While the family farm in Gettysburg was undergoing renovations until 1955, Ike took delight in the presidential retreat in Maryland's Catoctin Mountains. Franklin Roosevelt had called the place Shangri-La. This Ike vetoed. Too fancy for a Kansas farm boy, and found a name that echoed his days in military encampments, Camp David, named after his grandson. Inevitably, the president had a 3-hole golf course installed. There was trout fishing in the mountain brooks nearby, a handsome stone barbecue pit to grill steaks for a few friends, and even skeet shooting. Just the ticket for an avid outdoorsman. The evenings featured screenings of favorite Western films. It was middle-class paradise on a presidential scale. Washington society had some trouble adapting to the rather humdrum tastes of the first family. Long lunches and late nights were frowned upon. Cabinet officers were expected to turn down most invitations to elegant soirees. Ike did not much like to attend parties, and elite Washington hostesses declared themselves baffled by a president who preferred to stay at home in the evenings to watch television. Ike preferred light entertainment, such as the CBS television variety show put on by Arthur Godfrey and Western movies in the family quarters. The new domesticity did not please everyone. Collier's magazine sniffed that Mamie and Ike, living in what is probably the world's most publicized hunk of architecture, were playing it strictly suburban. The fact is that the atmosphere of the White House these days is more reminiscent of Dubuque than of Versailles. And that suited Eisenhower just fine. If the White House was not turned into a stage for sparkling entertainments, Eisenhower did rely heavily upon formal evening dinners with members of the power elite. He kept up a heavy schedule of men-only dinner parties to entertain political supporters, hear from business leaders, and receive reports on public opinion from men he had reason to trust. Each dinner followed a script. About 15 guests would arrive at 7:30 and chat casually before being seated at 8. A menu of national specialties from Alaska